following program has been furnished and paid by Nathan P. Rawls, CPA, and KSEV is not responsible for its content or the products or services offered.
Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance, or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path, and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Welcome to this week's Be a Planner Syndication Mass Show with Nathan Ross and Dan Dubose. I believe Dan will be joining us shortly. And before Dan comes on, I want to finish our disclaimer as normal, that just because you listened to this week's show or last week's show or a month ago's show, or you see us on a website, news article, etc., that we do not become your tax advisor. You really need to consult with those that already know your facts and circumstances. We would love to be in a position to do that. If you don't have someone, and you can go to the beaplanner.com website. That's beaplanner.com website, and you'll see a link there at the top right for intake forms. If you'll fill those out so that we can understand enough about you to give you some answers, we'll be happy to do that to see if we might be able to sync up with your objectives, which hopefully your objectives are to take advantage of one of the most stable types of investment currently. If you're trying to build your wealth, whether it's retirement wealth or wealth that's already in your money market accounts, stock market accounts, etc., which is that of real estate, private partnership syndications, specifically with respect to multifamily apartment buildings, which is what we focus on. And today we're going to pretty much turn it into a news day. There's been just a bunch of news and updates on the state of the rental market, the inflationary impact, why we continue to invest in these assets in spite of inflation. It's one of the best inflation hedges that I think is out there in the investment world. And I, if you don't believe me, just take a look at where BlackRock and assorted other private equity groups are putting their money. Warren Buffett, to mention another, and boy, has a lot of money flowed into this private partnership syndication market, and it's a pretty good it gives you a pretty good sense of where some of the smart money is going, or theoretically the smart money. They tend to have done pretty well in the past, if you've noticed. But in any event, I was also going to comment on, we're continuing to see some real interesting developments in Washington. The Democrats, it looks like, are kind of turning on Senator Manchin, who recently capitulated on the Inflation Reduction Act. But he was given assurances that there was going to be a change in the permitting rules that would allow his territory, that would be West Virginia, and others, but obviously he was looking out for the home team, to be able to more quickly move through the permitting process to get projects involving some of the old technology, the coal, I guess, maybe some oil and gas, tangentially, permitted, and then some of the new projects. He wants to help his constituents take advantage of the green options, which I'm not sure exactly in a heavy, heavy coal state. I'm not sure exactly what that translates to, but bottom line was that was part of the deal. And unfortunately, he didn't, I'm going to say he didn't get it in writing, meaning he did not have a bill that could be voted on simultaneously. Well, now they're trying to cram that into the continuing resolution, which is the budget. I believe it's still a continuing resolution. I don't think there's been any final resolutions in forever, the way Congress works when it comes to funding. And Senator Sanders and now Markey, I think I saw today, have just basically said, you know, we're not willing to do it as part of the CR. And that probably means they may not be willing to do it at all, but who knows the way this crowd operates. But anyway, so back to the current state of affairs in the real estate market. There was a article this past week on Market Watch. The headline is, "We're seeing a complete reversal of market conditions in just 12 months. Rents fell from July to August, the first decline in nearly 2 years." Now, this is obviously written based on the averages. And, you know, I've said many times on the air, nobody's average. We're all actual. Depends on where you're at in the country, which market, which submarket, which asset class or apartment class, class A, B, C, D, et cetera. And then that's where you've got to drill down and see what's really happened. But this article is noteworthy in that it's, well, first of all, it's put out by one of the largest players in the real estate market, be it office, commercial, or retail, multifamily, industrial, et cetera, CoStar. And CoStar is a huge organization that tracks many, many things in the multifamily space specifically. And they are involved in people buying, selling, et cetera, these properties through their websites. And they used to own, or I guess they still do own, LoopNet, which was the de facto corporate, if there is or was an MLS. It's not technically an MLS, but it's where all the commercial brokers will list their properties, and it's where a lot of buyers go to find properties or to find brokers that work in this space. That's really the best use of LoopNet. In any event, by the way, Dan, have you joined us yet? I think you were getting ready to call.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, great. Great. And those of you that have been listening to us recently realize Dan joins us most weeks, and Dan is one of my CPA associates, and you know, we always enjoy his insights. Dan, I was just looking at that article from Market Watch that we had discussed as we were getting ready today, and you know, the as I was just explaining, I mean, the numbers on these types of articles, unfortunately, are in most cases are based on averages. However, they do drill down into more than a couple submarkets, and specifically Nashville, which has been a pretty hot market for syndications, rents fell 1.1% or an $18 dip, which I know that doesn't sound like much, but you know, this inflationary trend has a while to go, and by the time you renew leases, you know, with people that are coming up on renewals, this has more than just a little ripple effect. And of course, a change in top line rent falls down to bottom line net operating income, or NOI, which is how projects get sold. It's how loans get made. It's you know, direct impact on one's ability to realize the economic benefits of their multifamily investment. And don't think it doesn't affect the buyer's mindset even more than what the actual data may be. You know, if someone's looking to buy, obviously you're dialing in a few more months or maybe a couple years worth of declines, right, Dan? I mean, that's a pretty heavy hit.
You know, you talked about Nashville. That decrease works out to about $1,800 a month rent. That's a lot of money for rent. But that same article talked about the decrease in San Francisco, even the West Coast area, where the rents are like $2,900. I don't know what they're talking about. I mean, average. You know, that's not a one unit or two unit. I mean, one bedroom, two
right,
bedroom.
Right. Right.
You know, right. Significant dollar difference just in your cost of living. Just look at that. Maybe that's one reason why so many people are moving east. You know, it used to be go west, young man. Now it's come back east, boy.
Well, San Francisco has its own problems. And, yeah, I mean, there's a number of factors that are really going to take a toll on a place like San Francisco. And, you know, when you look at the ability now of the young workers, the college grads coming out, et cetera, to work remotely from almost anywhere, that's really going to hurt a market like San Francisco. I've got some other articles queued up, and I think there's one that talks about that. That's a place that I would probably tend to avoid. Nashville, you know, that's going to be a strong market regardless, you know, because of some of the other unique dynamics to Nashville, and conversely, San Francisco's got major problems otherwise. Let's assume inflation was non-existent. You know, who's moving to San Francisco given the current state of affairs there with the homeless condition, with, you know, some of the crazy rules that the governor's put in place, or I say crazy, unrealistic probably is a better word, in terms of the timeline on getting all the green energy programs rolled out and, you know, the electric car mandate when they don't even have a modicum of a infrastructure for keeping those vehicles charged. In any event, it says still, moving on after the San Francisco comment, still, when you compare to last year, rental prices continue to grow. And this is what we've seen as we look at transactions day in, day out. Rents were up 7.1% in August from the same point in 2021. Again, averages. You know, some markets, I'm sure rents are down. In other markets, I'm sure rents have gone up more than 7.1%. I mean, this is an average. So think about at least half being under this level and half being over, just in a general sense. I mean, that's not exactly correct, but that's close enough. And we're going to tell you about some more projects that are going on that just boggle the mind that the opportunity, someone is still willing, i.e. a lender or a seasoned syndicator is still willing to put money into some of these markets where they're having rental declines. It makes you realize that it really does depend on your specific facts and circumstances. And location, quote unquote, is probably, I guess, the biggest denominator on where we see deviations. Wouldn't you say, Dan? It's comes back to strange, huh? Comes back to location, location, location. When things
classic,
get
classic
tight.
Real estate.
Yeah, or when they get tighter, tighter. Rents were up in most, or rents were up most in cities including Orlando, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Charlotte, and Salt Lake cities. All good locations, and so that's why you continue to see demand. And of course, in many of those markets, I don't know about the Florida markets, but I know with Charlotte, Salt Lake, places like that. The supply still lags demand. I believe that's a fair statement on the latter markets. Year over year rent data continues to give the impression that the multifamily market is performing meaningfully above previous averages, but major markets continue to retreat quickly at a time of year in which they've should have posted their best results. So it's definitely a mixed bag. And all I can tell you is, as we review transactions, we're looking more and more at some of the ancillary data that would support these 20 to 25% top-line rental growth numbers that we've been seeing for a while, and we've been questioning them for a while. And I'm not sure that this is the cold water being poured on those projections. Don't know that we're at that point yet, but you know, there's only so many fish swimming in the pond that can take those kind of rent increases. And you know, workforce housing, which is the classic Class C apartment building, is what I would suggest. Maybe the B minus or the B as well. Again, those people or the tenants in those properties will probably leave before they're going to pay 25% more in rent. They won't be able to in most cases. Dan, do you see that any differently?
You know, when they talk about these statistics on a national basis, it seems they forget those Class C's, and they're talking about the Class A and B. The C is where the most of the units available, I would imagine. I heard one guy talking recently about, he said nationwide there's a 6 million, 6 million, that's a huge number. That number, I'm talking about a shortage of housing by 6 million.
Yeah, I've seen that number. I've seen 4 million. I mean, it's a lot of units, whatever it is. And so I'm not sure how to translate
kind of shortage,
that.
It seems like rents are going up. You know, and there's just no way for it not to. But yet it's trending down right now as the, you know, trending down. You were talking about 0.1%, but that's a trend down from month over month. Now, that's a very short period to be averaging.
And again, that's in spots. And, I you know, for every spot that's trending down, there's a spot trending up to get to the average, I assume. It's a fair assumption. But you're right. That is a lot. Whether it's 4 million, 6 million, 2 million, it's a lot of supply, I mean of demand. And that's why this will give us a good pivot to the next article that appeared in Connect CRE, which is, you know, a research group, a facilitator, if you will, a portal for commercial real estate. And there's an article, let's see, this is, well, this was this past week. I don't have the date. Oh, September the 15th. So just a few days ago. The headline is Scottsdale Developer, so it's the Phoenix area, secures tricky construction loan for apartment project. So here we are in the face of declining rents in some places, and I think Phoenix is probably on that list, although Phoenix may be one where they're still going the other way. I didn't dig into that report by, Market Watch. I need to kind of pull it and look at some of the detail. But bottom line is a Scottsdale-based commercial developer has obtained $57.9 million in construction financing for a 187-unit multifamily development in North Tempe. Dan, how much is that a unit? You did the math on
that. That's $310,000 almost per unit, per door.
$310,000
to build it.
That's a nice apartment no matter where you're at, right? Pretty much. I say that. That's what they're spending in Houston these days. If you look at some of the Camden or Hanover type developments, I mean, in fact, it may be more than that. But in any event, this location, again, it's a mid-rise, will be located immediately adjacent to a Valley Metro light rail stop, offering residents convenient access to downtown Tempe, Arizona State University, Sky Harbor Airport, and downtown Phoenix. So it sounds like, I mean, I'm somewhat familiar with that area. It's been a while since I've been out there, but went out to a graduation at Arizona State a number of years ago, and it's definitely an upscale area. And if they're on that light rail, which I'm not sure it existed when I was there, that would be quite a coup. And it is amazing, you know, as much as we complain about rail, how connecting different spots of a geographical area impacts the building. I know here where I'm at in Bangkok, we've got the SkyTrain. We've got a SkyTrain, which is above ground. We've got a subway, which is underground. And we've got a bus system, a rapid transit bus system that's in different spots, heavier or more densely populated spots. And then we got about 90,000 of the cheapest taxis in the world. I mean, literally a 40-minute drive may be a $10 fare. It's crazy cheap. And but in any event, it's been interesting to watch that BTS, the above ground SkyTrain, as it's expanded during the 16 years or so that I've been coming back and forth to Thailand, at the condo developments that just pop up. I mean, right after it's announced that they're expanding it in this direction or that direction, it's crazy the amount of money. Almost 2 million condos in that same period that I mentioned from 2006 on have gone up, and a lot of them have been along that the arteries of that SkyTrain. So it gives people the opportunity that otherwise would have to live close to where they work to basically work anywhere in the city with a relatively cheap way of getting there. But back to this, the way that this, I mean, this isn't just almost $58 million in construction financing, Dan. This is something I haven't seen much of in my lifetime. Non-recourse, 90% loan to cost, construction loan is what this consisted of, but it had a participating feature. So the structure that they put in place allows the lender to share in the profits with the developer in exchange for the higher leverage financing. And to top all that off, it's a 5-year interest-only loan with a fixed rate of 4.25%. When I first read this, I was looking back up at the top trying to find that date again, because we haven't seen this level of interest rates in quite some time. But I guess it's such a strong proposal, and I'm going to tell you the capper here in a minute. I still haven't told you the best part. That's pretty incredible, no, Dan? 5 years, interest only, 4.25%. It's like ching, ching, ching. You know, they're hitting all the stops. And 90% LTC, so, you know, they're going to have to come, out of pocket with about $6 million, I suppose, or maybe they'll raise it with some other investors. But what's the real kicker on this thing, Dan? What's in the last sentence of this article?
I don't have that up. I'm sorry.
Oh, you don't have it in front of you. Well, I'm going to tell you. The construction budget grew significantly. Now, think about this deal. You didn't just pop this out, last week. They've been working on this thing a while, trying to get all the permitting and entitlements so they could even build this thing. So the construction budget grew significantly during the longer than expected permitting process, but they were able to lock in a final loan amount that was nearly 40% higher than that of the original loan application in 2021. That is crazy to think that a lender stuck in, and maybe it wasn't the same lender, I don't know, but to think that they hung in on that, it blows my mind. And Dan, you've developed some apartments in your ute way back when, what, in the late 80s, I guess, mid 80s?
Yeah, and I never had a lender come and say, hey, let me give you 40% more for that loan.
Well, that, or let me give you a 90% LTC and we'll do that on the come. We'll wait to get some participation dollars out, right? That's pretty significant. And there were some crazy things going back during the SNL days, right? I mean, I think that's when you developed some things. And, of course, there were some things that ended up being not real good. Hey, let's take a break. We've got more of these articles we want to discuss because it really gives you a good feel for what's going on around other parts of the country, although this Phoenix Southwest area is pretty rich right now with things. But anyway, let's take a quick break. We'll be back with more of the Be a Planner Syndication Mass Show with Nathan Ross and Dan DuBose. I want to be rich no matter how much it costs. Eyes on a wind no matter how
The Syndication Math Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, focuses exclusively on helping investors understand the current options for investing. The syndication arena has changed. You can now take advantage of direct online investing options without expensive upfront membership fees. Nathan Ross, CPA, discusses these options and more, including the math involved with partnership selection, reporting, and performance. On the Syndication Math Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, Sundays at 7 a.m. right here on KSEV.
Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-581-0195, 713-581-0195, or you can send an email to Nathan at npross.com, Nathan at npross.com.
Whether you're a seasoned investor or just getting started with real estate private partnership syndications, you can now take advantage of direct online investing options. Tune in Sundays at 7 a.m. to the Be a Planner Syndication Math Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, right here on KSEV.
Okay, welcome back to the Be a Planner Syndication Math Show with Nathan and Dan today. Nathan Ross and Dan Dubose, CPAs. And we've been running through a plethora of news articles. It's interesting how, well, it's not interesting, I suppose, to you, the listener. It's interesting to us as to how the market is changing so fast just before our eyes, both good and bad. And we've been talking about some projects that are getting ready to see the light of day, apparently, or some, like this one, Dan. You remember the article we discussed about the vintage Phoenix apartments that were acquired, I believe, this past week for $80 million, almost $81 million. 1972 construction. Let's do the math on this, Dan. I think you may already have it there. 380 units. That's right. Go ahead. I'm going to let you describe it.
Let me see here. I hadn't calculated that.
Well, it's 384 unit, 1972 construction. So this is no young pup. And I can contrast this to 1970s, early 70s construction in Houston, just to give you some idea. They're going to invest on top of the $80 million, they're going to invest another $5 million, so that's about $86 million. Just the acquisition price works out to $210,000 a unit. That's a pretty hefty price. I would tell you that if this property were sitting in Houston, it might be $150,000 a door, all things being equal, right? And then you throw on the extra $5 million to renovate a number of the units there and some common area improvements and deferred maintenance, which is pretty common, if you will, on properties of this age. The let's see, they arranged a Freddie Mac senior loan, so it's got agency debt. I mean, it's still pretty amazing that in spite of what you read on other fronts, that, you know, the debt market is still participating with these developers. And, I mean, it's tightened up. I mean, there's no question. You see a lot more bridge debt. We've been talking about that occurrence now for months where, you know, the typical, I mean, 90, I guess I should nudge the number down just a bit. Maybe it's 98% instead of 99, I think is what we've said, is a three-year bridge loan with 2 1-year extensions. And that gives the lender, obviously, the ability to push progress, I guess you might say, right, Dan?
Yeah. You know, part of the what we're talking about here lately, too, is his cap rates. Cap rates are coming down from what one of the articles said, too. It's not a great amount. It's, 0.18, 18 basis points, 20 basis points, depending on the class, so to speak. But it's coming down. With that, the values are going up. You know, if you get your rents are going up. Cap rate going down.
Say again. Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy. I would tell you the cap rates, when we look at transactions now, if they acquired at a 4 cap or let's say 4.5 cap rate, which is a pretty quality project. I mean, when you think about it, it's, you know, I know we still see some projects being acquired at 5.5. I think I've seen a 6 out there, but, you know, we see projects occasionally that are acquired at 4.5 and they're showing a lower cap rate on exit, which means they think the property's getting more valuable just based on the interest rate movement, right? Which seems counterintuitive. But I would tell you that if you're not factoring in, what, Dan, a quarter of a point each year or half a point each year, like I think it's a half a point is what we've been doing when you look at the go-forward. So if it's a five-year deal, you're buying it at a 4, we're assuming 6.5 on exit is probably, I think I've got that right. I need to go back and look at that underwriting model.
It is moving up, yeah, on the, as you go out. Yeah. You're getting more.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't. Yeah, there's no way I would use that high coming down. But in any event, I tell you, a lot of these syndicators and sponsors are not, they're not doing that. And I don't understand it. I mean, surely they understand. I guess, you know, it's one of those, it's just one of the other issues that we find when we review these transactions that a layperson typically is not going to understand the sensitivity of a number of factors. And cap rate, boy, is that's probably the biggest one. I mean, that and NOI assumptions, right? So
we've got to have the NOI to get the cap rate started anyway, so you better be operating efficiently.
Yeah. So. Speaking of, I want to pivot, hold this spot, but let's pivot to an article that Tax Foundation came out with this past week, the 13th. Taxfoundation.org, one of my favorite sites. Truthinaccounting.org and Taxfoundation.org are two sites. You know, they're free for the most part. In fact, I think all their information's free. Good quality, independent, unbiased information, and they talk about the impact of property taxes with, you know, the different locations around the country, and it's pretty telling. And as they point out, property taxes are the primary tool for financing local government and generating state-level revenue. In some states, you know, obviously income tax can be a material number in some as well. But in fiscal 2020, I guess is the latest year they've got good data. Property taxes comprise 32.2% of total state and local tax collections in the U.S., more than any other source of tax revenue. Think about that. That's a huge impact on the way your state or your county or your city can operate when it comes to funding schools, roads, police departments, fire and emergency medical services, as well as the other services associated with residency or property ownership. I mean, that's a lot to say in one sentence, but that's pretty much the whole kit and caboodle when you think about it, Dan. And property taxes accounted for 72.2% of local tax collections in fiscal year 2020. So state level versus local, and it's a huge chunk of the revenues. And I know if you look at Houston and San Antonio, Austin, Dallas, this year was such a shocker to those of us that own property. And, you know, what's crazy is these taxes have a way of going up. And, of course, it's not the tax rate. You know, if you ask your city councilman, well, you know, why aren't you doing something to help us lower our tax rate? They'll say, well, you know, that's not us. We don't have any control of that. That's the appraisal district, you know, the county that sets those values. Right, Dan? I'm sure you've heard that.
Yeah, as one guy I heard recently talk about it, he said, you go to your appraisal district and try to negotiate. He said, they don't care. They don't care.
Right. You know, that's right.
They
that's
don't right. care. They only want that value. It is important that we have values correctly stated because, you know, taxes, property taxes, are to be spread, let's say, evenly or genuinely.
Fairly.
Fairly.
It's called equitable.
There's a word. Thank you.
Yeah.
Equitable.
Yeah. I remember in San Antonio, where I've got property, there was a gentleman there in the neighborhood. I'm not going to mention names, but he had a unique property, let's say. And he was a state senator. And do you know, Dan, that the value of that property was about 20% of what anything else size-wise. And, of course, in real estate, you delineate things by price per foot or value per square foot, et cetera. Never understood. I mean, that property was right around the corner from me. There was not significant deferred maintenance before you start giving me all the reasons why he probably got a lower deal. No, it was, you know, a question of not being equitable to the other, to his constituents. You know, it's the worst thing, right? But well, in any event, you know, yeah. Well, what I've learned is that, you know, most property tax appraisals, first of all, they're computer generated. Second of all, they assume a perfect, pristine property. So if you're one that has significant deferred maintenance, unless you appeal it, and I don't mean you appeal it and you go into some pool of 10,000 properties like in a informal hearing or maybe you go to arbitration where the details of your properties never get looked at. No, you've got to at least act like you're going to litigate to get to a level where you'll have someone that has an incentive to look at your details and agree that, hey, we really don't want to go to court on this because it looks like you've got some, you know, righteous adjustments. So if you're appealing your property taxes, which, you know, it's a little bit late now to file the request, but it's not too late if you've already filed it, you've gone through an informal, you did not settle at the informal hearing, and now you're going to a formal hearing, or maybe you finished the formal hearing and you're still not happy, that's when you might consider, hopefully you've got somebody representing you already that will be on the call for litigation. But I've learned firsthand, saved a bunch of money by simply saying, hey, that's fine. We'll see if a jury or a court or a judge will agree with us on what our proposed adjustments are. Anyway, the key point here is that, you know, comparing property taxes across states is difficult because there's local issues or locally levied. Typically, that would be the county in our case in Texas appraises property. But in any event, the median property taxes paid will vary widely across and even within the 50 states. The lowest bills in the country are in six counties or county equivalents, if they're not called a county, with median property taxes of less than $200 a year. You want to guess where those are, Dan? The general areas?
Alaska.
How'd you guess that? Northwest Arctic Borough and Kuzovlak census area. Almost sounds Russian. I guess it is close to Russia, huh? Counties in Louisiana, three of them. I can't even say one of them. Avoyelles, East Carroll, what? And Madison, and then Choctaw in Alabama. So I don't see any big names on that list, right? So I would tell you the bigger, although I don't know, maybe those are counties, those aren't cities, so I'm not sure what the population are. So there's a footnote here on the Alaska counties. Significant parts of Alaska have no property taxes, though most of these areas have such small populations, they aren't included in federal surveys. But anyway, it's the property taxes, as I have said before, and in fact we talked yesterday about an article that pointed out that the average American pays more in income tax than they do for food, clothing, shelter. I forget everything that's included in that list. And again, that's average. You know, we're not average, we're actual. So we could be paying a lot more or a lot less, I suppose. Although I doubt many listeners to this show are, than what they're spending on taxes. And that was income taxes only. My God, when you factor in property taxes, it's probably likely even more true.
In Texas, of course, we don't have an income tax, but we do have a rather high property tax, which has been discussed. And, you know, the owner of this radio station has been very active in that regard over the years, you know, fighting property taxes, and it's still very high. You know, we used to talk about the East Coast and the West Coast being high taxes. Well, you look at that map, it's at that same article, you can see the Gulf Coast is now coming up to be one of those high tax states. You know, it's particularly in some counties, namely Harris County, which is very, very high on a property tax bill relative to most of the rest of Texas. Dallas-Fort Worth, San Antonio, where you've got big high populations or growing populations, those areas too are paying rather high tax. It is not a cheap thing. It's not an inexpensive thing for us as planners to, you know, plug into your planning map. You know, taxes are limited now to only $10,000. Your state taxes are limited to $10,000. But there's many people in my client list that are paying much more than that $10,000. It's an expensive item that's not even tax deductible anymore. It's hard to plan around that when you got a very, very low, not even cost of living adjusted amount.
Yeah. What, Dan, do you recall? I know I saw it at one point. Do you recall the average increase in property tax valuations in Harris County for 2022?
I don't have an exact number, but it's well into double digits, you know.
I know that. I was thinking it was somewhere between 30 and 35%. It wasn't quite Austin level. Austin was about 40% on average. San Antonio, I believe, was 25. And of course, that's not necessarily going to be what gets collected. But I'll tell you, there's an article, July of 2022, where the Harris County Auditor recently released its monthly report for February 2022, which is the county's fiscal year end. And the Harris County folks collected over $113 million more from residents than the year before, which represents a 7% increase. That's in collections. So, you know, after the appraisals go up and then you go appeal, and by the way, that doesn't reflect the huge increase for this year. It's going to be really interesting to see how much and, you know, to give you a little bit of background, this is a good article. It goes back, says these extreme revenues that were in effect, there were revenue caps, allowed the county to collect new revenues seven times the rate of inflation at a time that the county's population barely increased. Had the tax increases proposed by, as Michael Berry calls her, Commandant Hidalgo, Ellis and Garcia, the two other county commissioners that like to spend like there's no tomorrow, the county would have collected almost 20%, or roughly $350 million more from Harris County taxpayers last year. These people should be in handcuffs. This is insanity that in the face of COVID and the economy and lockdowns, shutdowns, where do they expect people are going to get their money to pay this failure, or, I mean, this increase? And I don't know. I mean, it's just it's hard to understand. And, of course, the Commissioner Raddick and Cagle are two conservative lights, I guess you might say, boycotted the meeting where they blocked the proposed increase. Thank goodness for some common sense. But of course, Hidalgo with her youthful, unfortunately, they're at an age where they don't have the significant knowledge base that guys your age do, Dan, you know, where you've been through a few rough spots in life. And her quote was, unfortunately, today, Commissioners Cagle and Raddick chose to hide rather than face the tough reality of the impact that extreme revenue caps will have on our county, and called the failure to increase taxes. Now, this is your local elected leader. The failure to increase taxes by 8% was, quote, dangerous, end quote. I'll tell you what's dangerous. It's having people with that mindset at the helm of your ship, right? Very dangerous. But anyway, okay, so back to the Phoenix Southwest area, which I'm assuming is probably laden with property taxes. I didn't look at, maybe you did, Dan, that tax foundation, the details. But there's another notable transaction that I know it's new. It's 2022, so it's early this year. Construction, 286 units with all the normal amenities, keyless entry systems, computer workstations, front loading washers and dryers. Just go down the list. Notably, it does have carpet in the bedrooms. I guess, are we making a move back to carpet? I thought we'd gotten away from carpet.
I hope not.
Say again.
I hope not.
Yeah, I do too. But anyway, this group completed the sale of the Cabana 99th, a multifamily community in Glendale. Group that bought it paid $93.5 million for 286 units. That is $326,000 a door. That's a lot of money, even for a Class A apartment building. And I don't know, they don't say, but I'm assuming those were not all rented at this point in time. But think about the significant cap rate, and I don't mean significantly high. I'm assuming, I guess we could do the math if we had more time, but that's definitely a sign that someone is thinking big for the go-forward.
The Glendale project is brand new in this year. That's what you indicated, wasn't it? It's
right,
and they call it well-appointed and budget conscious people. I mean, they're going to have some major high rents there at $326,000+ per unit. They've got a
$326,000+.
Yeah, $326,000+.
Right? Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Just the old 1% rule of thumb, which probably isn't really the rule of thumb on this stuff. That's $3,270 a month. So now this again, locations are. Wait a minute. Is this the one that discusses the location? Maybe it's not, but I'm sure the location has to be pristine. But man, it's just amazing. Let's see, Dan, what other developments on this Southwest discussion look like they might be? Most of it's office, some hotels. Boy, the hotel market, I guess a lot of hotels have taken advantage of the COVID time to upgrade. Been a lot of upgrades, reinvestments in hotels, but I guess I would suggest the hotel probably has a brighter future than the office does. And in fact, there's an article here about half of an iconic Tucson high-rise office being converted to hotel. I guess these guys have figured it out, right?
Wow.
People want to travel. They may or may not want to stay in hotels. I know we've had a uptick in rentals at our two boutique properties. But they definitely want to get out of the house, and they do not want to go back to the office. That seems to be clear, although I've seen where more than a few companies are mandating return to the office. People like Goldman Sachs, I think Apple has done that. And yet there's others that are going the other way and say they'll do remote indefinitely, which I suppose there's good and bad, but in any event. Well, we're coming to the end of the show once again, Dan, and this has been interesting for me to go through. It's been a while since we've just talked news, but I guess the takeaway is things are still happening in the multifamily space in a big way,
that's
whether right
news.
Or wrong.
Things
yeah, that's the good news.
In a big way, yes.
Yeah, but it also puts an emphasis on underwriting and on looking at pro formas, how they were developed, to make sure that if you're putting your money into this space that you're doing so wisely. Dan, thanks for joining us today. And if any of you would like to speak to Dan or I or have us look at your specific facts and circumstances, go to beaplanner.com, BEAPLANNER.com. Fill out the intake forms, schedule a phone call, and we'll be happy to take some time to see how we can sync up with your needs and objectives. Thank you, Dan, and thanks for tuning in today.
Thanks for listening to Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. Be sure to tune in next Saturday at 5 for another edition of Be a Planner Show here on AM 700 KSEB.